Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. At a rally in Houston for Republican Senator Ted Cruz last night, President Trump went all out with his closing argument 2 weeks ahead of the midterm election. He said that next week he'll be putting in a 10% tax cut for middle-income families.
We're going to be putting in a 10% tax cut for middle-income families. It's going to be put in next week.
Ashley Parker, White House reporter for The Washington Post, joins us now. Hi, Ashley.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. So that is not true, what he just said. He is not going to be able to pass another tax cut next week. Congress isn't even in session.
That's correct. And that's one of those things he's said where no one, when he first said it, you know, we were going crazy trying to figure out what he meant, what he was doing. And as we started making calls, no one in Congress knew. No one in his administration knew. No one really seemed to know.
So why is he saying that he is doing that?
I assume he thinks it's a good messaging strategy, right? People like tax cuts. That would be a popular thing to do if you could push a tax cut through in the next 13 days before the midterms. That would be really buzzy and big.
Mm-hmm. But he won't be able to do that. He also claimed last night in this rally that unknown Middle Easterners were mixed in with a group of 7,000 Central Americans currently more than a month away by foot from the U.S. border. Also not true, or at least there's no evidence that there are unknown Middle Easterners in that group.
Right. The president has been asked, the White House has been asked, and they have not been able to provide any examples, evidence, or specifics of what the president is referring to.
Ashley, he also returned to a claim that he made during the 2016 campaign that immigrants who are here illegally are voting illegally. Let's listen.
I got so many people voting illegally in this country. It's a disgrace, okay? It's a disgrace.
Now, that has long been debunked. It's not happening.
Correct. That is also not happening. He's also talked about Democrats funding this caravan and kind of implying that they're funding them because these migrants will cross over the border and then vote in 13 days. And that's also false. That's not how our system works.
Mm-hmm. So are his supporters going to care if they find out later that some of these things, or especially that the middle class tax cut is not true, that actually isn't going to happen in the next week?
If history is any evidence, and I mean immediate history, going back to basically his 2015-2016 campaign, they will not care, or if they do care, they will not punish him for this at the ballot box. The president then, as a candidate, was sort of the first person who ushered in this post-truth era where he realized that, you know, lots of politicians that say things that aren't quite true, they're often not quite as false as the things this president says. But when they are fact-checked, whether it's by the Washington Post fact-checker or any of these newspapers and organizations that do fact-checking, there is often a public penalty they pay with voters. And so they change their rhetoric, not because they necessarily care that the Washington Post gave them four Pinocchios, mm-hmm. but because they care that their voters care. And with President Trump, that was not the case. He sort of quickly realized that he could say what he wanted, and whether it was true or not, he would not be held to account by the media. He would, but not by his voters. Mm-hmm. It's also worth noting when it's pointed out, when the media points out, he's saying something that isn't quite true. He will just say, well, that's the fake news media. They're lying.
Well, and Fox News, which has been very friendly to President Trump, hasn't been running his rallies in full. But last night I watched, they ran it from beginning to end in Texas. And there was no point at which anybody came on and said any of the things that he said were not true.
That's true. I will say it. I think it has been hard for news organizations, any news organization, frankly, to fact check the president at his rallies in real time. I remember kind of early on, you would see some cable outlets try to do that on their Chiron below the screen. But that does not seem to be something, frankly, that any television channel has done a good job of mastering, Fox or otherwise.
I want to ask you about one more thing that happened last night. The president said this. He was referring to power-hungry globalists, the kind of language we haven't heard since Steve Bannon was in the White House. And then he said this.
You know, they have a word. it sort of became old-fashioned. It's called a nationalist. And I say, really, we're not supposed to use that word. You know what I am? I'm a nationalist, okay? I'm a nationalist.
What'd you make of that moment, Ashley?
On the one hand, it's not surprising because the way the president cast his definition of a nationalist is someone who puts America first, right? Which is what he's been very clear about is his goal and his campaign slogan the entire time. On the other hand, it was quite interesting because this was an administration that started off with a real roiling debate between the sort of so-called globalist faction and the nationalist faction. And now, even though Steve Bannon is gone, who we sort of think of as the original nationalist, in general, the people the president is bringing in and surrounding himself with are the people who feed that more gut, visceral, nationalistic interest of the president.
That's Ashley Parker, a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Ashley, thank you.
Thank you.
China today opened the world's longest sea bridge, linking Hong Kong to the mainland. China says the bridge will boost the economy, but 7 workers died during its construction, and conservationists worry the bridge could kill off the endangered Chinese white dolphin. CNN international correspondent Will Ripley joins us now from Hong Kong on Skype. And Will, describe this bridge, the sheer scale of it.
You know, China does infrastructure projects. They really rarely do anything small. But even by Beijing standards, this thing is big. It is now the largest sea crossing ever, the longest. It's 34 miles connecting Hong Kong and Macau, the two Chinese territories, to the mainland city of Zhuhai. China's kind of argument is that it cuts the travel time from 3 hours to 30 minutes. But the catch is that Hong Kongers who paid, you know, through their taxes, $9 billion of the $20 billion budget, they can't even drive their cars on it. They would need a special permit. Only buses and government vehicles can go on the bridge. So there are a lot of lawmakers and critics here who say this is a big white elephant. Beijing sending a symbol to Hong Kong, which had the umbrella movement protests a few years back, that they are under the increasingly firm grip of the mainland and not to forget it.
Yeah. What is the political significance of linking Hong Kong with it's almost like an umbilical cord to the mainland?
That's exactly how one lawmaker here, Claudia Mo, described it to me today. And when you're flying in to Hong Kong, you see this long bridge. I mean, it's really a striking sight. Just 1 month ago today, they opened up a high-speed rail line connecting Hong Kong to Guangzhou, China. Step by step, people here feel like Beijing is physically putting its stamp on this city.
$20 billion a decade to build. But the government, is making the argument that there is an economic boost to be had here. Is that true?
They are expecting an influx in mainland Chinese tourists, you know, on those buses that are going to be allowed to travel on the bridge, because certainly not private cars. Hong Kong already has a pretty massive tourism industry. 56 million tourists per year, which is about 20 million more than the UK, which is a much larger country. So the retail sector, the service industry could benefit, but at what cost to the city itself, to things like to traffic, to the citizens and their quality of life? You know, people already are concerned that when you walk down the sidewalks, it's so crowded, primarily with mainland tourists, that it's difficult to get around some of the more populated areas in the city. The lines at tourist attractions like the tram that goes up to the peak, which gives you a nice overview of the city, that is always, you know, multiple hours, especially during, you know, busy times of the day. So people are fearful that those kinds of things are going to get worse for the people actually living in Hong Kong as more visitors flock here.
How much does this bolster President Xi's image? We've been reporting so much about China's efforts to undertake these huge infrastructure projects in places like the South China Sea, military infrastructure projects. Is this a part of that in a way?
I mean, China prides itself in completing these massive projects. And yes, those artificial islands in the South China Sea, obviously controversial, but that's China putting its stamp on territory that it claims, even though those claims are rejected by the United States and many countries here in the region and around the world. As far as, you know, other, you know, civilian type infrastructure, this is now the 6th largest bridge in the world, the one that is opening here in Hong Kong. Guess where the other 5 largest bridges are? They're all located in China. And it just goes to show that, you know, China wants to prove to the world that it can get these things done. And the bridge itself is a wonder of engineering. They have 4.5 times the steel of San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge, 2 artificial islands, an undersea tunnel. You know, even though it took 9 years to build and, you know, there were considerable delays, it is an absolutely breathtaking sight to look at a bridge that on a clear day goes as far as the eye can see.
Wow. And were you on it?
We've been on it. We haven't been able to cross over to the Chinese side. As a journalist, it's actually very difficult for me to go into China without a very extensive visa process. But for people who live in Hong Kong, they'll be able to buy a ticket, get on a bus, and for a significantly less money than what they have to pay right now, they'll be able to travel much more quickly and efficiently. But for Hong Kongers who'd like to maintain their sense of semi-independence and don't want even more Chinese influence than what there already is, well, obviously they're concerned. You know, one lawmaker told me today that even though 2047 is supposed to be the deadline that China allows Hong Kong to maintain its capitalist system and way of life without interference, she feels, and many others feel, that this bridge has moved up that 2047 date by maybe a decade or two, which means that for people growing up here in Hong Kong, the message is being sent very clearly. They are part of the mainland, and they have to always remember that it's the motherland with a capital M. No negotiations, no questions asked, and certainly no protests.
CNN international correspondent Will Ripley speaking with us from Hong Kong about the world's longest sea crossing bridge that opened today, linking Hong Kong to mainland China. Will, thanks. Very interesting.
All right, cheers.
The ride-hailing company Lyft is bringing electric scooters to Washington, D.C. It's the first East Coast city to get scooters from Lyft, but scooters are already widespread in the nation's capital, with companies like Bird, Lime, and Skip already offering rentable, dockless electric scooters for short trips around the city. Jeff Marudian is the director of the Washington, D.C. Department of Transportation. He joins us now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeremy.
So how many scooters are there in D.C. right now, approximately?
Well, we currently have upwards of 2,000 dockless vehicles, both bikes and scooters combined.
And how long have they been around?
We launched a pilot program about a year ago to allow these companies to demonstrate the technology here in Washington, D.C.
About a year ago. And have people been happy with them so far, or what are they saying?
Well, we've gotten a lot of feedback about their use, and certainly there are several people who have really begun to use these as a part of their daily commuting experience, and others who are using them for periodic trips.
To go a long distance, or how far are they going to commute with a scooter?
Well, we've seen different types of trips. In some cases, they are short distances. In some cases, they are longer connection distances, getting to and from metro stations, for example. So there are a number of use cases that we have observed over the past year.
And one of the things that a lot of cities have said about these scooters, one of the problems that they've seen is that people just leave them on the sidewalks and they clog up the sidewalks. And then if you're disabled and you're trying to use your wheelchair and get down the sidewalk, you could get stuck because there are a bunch of scooters in front. Are you seeing that there?
This is something that we heard very early on during the demonstration period, and it's something that we took very seriously in working with the companies to ensure that they were enforcing our rules and regulations and that their rules and regulations in terms of use were reflective of those things. And that has become something that we're working very closely to enforce, and we see the incidence of those things decreasing.
And do you have a good relationship with the companies? Are you in contact with them regularly?
We have been working with them to collect data and information and also to report problems that we hear from members of the public here in Washington, D.C. And so we have opened a line of communication with them to ensure that we're sharing information and that they are sharing information with us.
And they are sharing information with you.
That's correct.
So obviously one of the big concerns is safety, and just last month, there was an SUV that hit and killed a man who was riding a rented electric scooter in Washington, D.C. Apparently, that was the first time that somebody has died in an accident in the U.S. on one of these scooters. What do you know about that, or what can you tell us about that, and how you're making sure that that doesn't happen again, at least to the extent that you can try to stop it from happening again?
Sure. Well, D.C. is a city that is committed to Vision Zero, which is a strategy that under the leadership of our mayor, we have put in place to eliminate roadway fatalities and serious injuries. And we are doing everything that we can, taking it very seriously to work with the technology companies that are here to ensure that their rules and regulations are followed by their users. We're also taking a number of steps to ensure that we're building the safest possible infrastructure. It's worth noting that all forms of transportation come with inherent risks. And so we're working with these companies specifically to ensure that they are promoting the safest possible use for their users, and that we are informing the public about this new form of technology, this new form of mobility that is on the road.
Well, one of the things that people have said about the safety risk of these scooters is that a lot of the people who ride them, not just in Washington, but all over the country, aren't wearing helmets, and that they're out on the roads with cars, but they're not wearing any helmets. Do they have to wear helmets in D.C.?
Currently, the law in D.C. For helmets is limited to individuals who are 16 or under. Some of the companies, as you may know, do give away helmets. And they strongly incentivize riders to use helmets. And that's something that I think companies are thinking about as this technology moves forward.
And what about a government? What about the District of Columbia? Are you thinking, or are people in D.C. thinking about putting in a law that says that people have to wear helmets if they're riding these rented scooters?
You know, I can't speak to what lawmakers may or may not do with respect to changing the current helmet law. Certainly, we are always encouraging both cyclists and people who are using scooters to be as safe as possible, and that includes wearing a helmet.
So you get to see the data, as you've said. What are you finding about how this is changing transportation in D.C.? Is it having a big effect?
It's very early to tell what the impacts will be overall to commuting patterns and to traveling and to trips taken. That's really why we have decided to do this in an incremental approach to allow a capped number of these vehicles on the street to observe their use patterns, but also to really dive deep into the data to get a better understanding of how the public is interacting with them.
And right now the capped number is what?
The cap number is 400 per company.
Okay. And so now we're talking about with the addition of Lyft.
Currently in the district, there are five companies.
Five companies. Jeff, you've been in Washington now for a number of years. How big is the addition of electric scooters, dockless, rentable electric scooters, compared to any other change that you've seen in transportation, including, by the way, Uber and Lyft over the years?
I'm glad that you mentioned Uber and Lyft, because there was a time when that technology first emerged and came into the market that people were asking a lot of the same types of questions that we are now asking about dockless bikes and scooters. This is a significant change. It's one that provides a new mobility opportunity. And under the leadership of our mayor, Muriel Bowser, it's something that we have embraced, but have done so in a very incremental way to ensure that the technology is utilized in a safe way for the residents and visitors of the District of Columbia.
There are still a lot of cities in this country that do not allow the scooters in. I'm in one of them right now. What would your advice be to other cities that are considering whether to allow dockless electric rentable scooters on the roads?
My advice is really to listen to the public. We very deliberately opened up a comment period where we got lots of feedback and lots of information from the public from really all across the spectrum. And that's something that we take very seriously. We analyze it and we use it to inform the policy making going forward.
That's Jeff Meridian, who is director of the Washington, D.C. Department of Transportation. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
This year's school shootings in Parkland, Florida, and Santa Fe, Texas, have led many high schoolers to take political stands on school safety and gun control. But they've also left others feeling disconnected from the political process. Aviva Okeson-Haberman with KBIA spoke with Missouri high school students and their teachers to find out what they think about politics.
It's Thursday morning in Allison Breyer's American Government class at Boonville High School. Today's discussion topic is the election. The students shuffle in, some of them in brightly colored 80s workout clothes, for School Spirit Week. Breyer tells her class something that political candidates know well. Most teens don't vote.
When you're talking about why the politicians are not speaking to the issues that you guys care about, it's partly because you don't show up to vote. So why should they?
More than 50 miles away in Jefferson City, the state's capital, Julia LePage Mawson is having a similar conversation with her American government class.
What do you get if you go register to vote? What do I give you? Not extra credit. It's, what's it called? Life points.
Some 17% of registered high school age voters in this area went to the polls during Missouri's August primary. The average turnout rate of registered voters was about 40%. And high school teachers don't expect the November election to change that trend. New Franklin High School teacher Adam Quest says he's not sure students know about the tight Senate race between Democratic U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill and her challenger, Republican Missouri Attorney General Josh Hawley.
Quite honestly, I don't know that most of them are even aware that there is an election coming up.
This lack of engagement is not the case for all high schoolers.
Hi there.
Hi.
My name's Emma. And, I was just wondering if I could ask you a couple of quick questions.
Sure.
It's Friday evening after a week of homework and golf course tournaments for St. Dominic High School senior Emma Story. She's knocking on doors for the Missouri GOP.
I'm really excited to really have like a direct voice or direct effect in democracy this year.
One political issue that high schoolers across the country have organized around this year is school safety, following school shootings in Florida and Texas. Tiana Vaughn, a senior at Jefferson City High School, says she participated in her school's walkout to protest gun violence.
There were so many different shootings, and everybody was just kind of like, oh, pray for them, but there was nothing getting done. And then with the one in Florida, they were doing marches, and I was like, yes, we're finally doing something, you know?
Vaughn says school shootings and police brutality are two important issues for her. She's planning on voting.
I've gone with my grandma to vote before, but I think it's going to be a little bit different voting for, like, myself, you know.
Josie Johnson, a junior at Boonville High School, still has a couple more years before she's eligible to vote. She says school safety is also something that's on her mind. She doesn't think all of the adults in her life get it.
I feel like some of them haven't really had to be in that position to where they would like sit in a classroom and be like, oh, like, hey, someone might end up walking in here with a gun.
Bunston High School senior Kayla Burnett doesn't think regulating guns is the solution, though. Guns make her feel safe.
We used to live where there was a lot of coyotes, and we had a lot of chickens, and they would come kill them, and I've had a shoot one before, so at least scare one off.
Burnett says Second Amendment rights and limiting abortions are important to her, but Burnett admits she's not as familiar with the candidates.
Honestly, don't know who Josh Hawley is. I know that makes me sound crazy.
Burnett isn't the only high schooler who doesn't know about this vitriolic, high-stakes Senate campaign. And when it came time to register to vote, she didn't. For Here and Now, I'm Aviva Okeson-Haberman in Columbia, Missouri.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
More than a million people in Austin have been warned to boil their water before they drink or cook with it. Here's the city's water director, Greg Mezaros.
It's imperative that not only you boil water that you're going to consume, but you do all that you can to reduce the amount of water that you use until we can get through this event.
The warning is a result of last week's historic rainfall and flooding in central Texas. Officials say silt and mud has contaminated the city's water supply and could contain harmful bacteria. Mose Bouchel is a senior reporter at KUT covering energy and the environment, and he joins us now from Austin. Mose, it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
City leaders say not only could this water be dangerous to drink, but that Austin could actually run out of water altogether. How unprecedented is this?
Absolutely unprecedented. They say they've never dealt with anything like this since the water utility has been here. It seems as though, like you say, we're struggling with two different problems. One is water quality and one is water quantity. They need enough water in the system just to keep pressure in to, you know, for firefighting, for very essential services. So while they struggle with all this mud and silt, they're also worrying about the quantity. And the two things are absolutely related.
So what about that mud and silt? It came down through the river. I mean, you were on this program. We were talking about last week's flood. They were just historic. So the cleanup job to get rid of that mud and silt has got to be pretty big as well.
Yeah, they say they've never seen water like this in the treatment system. And if you go down to the river or go to our reservoirs and look at it, it does look like chocolate milk. You know, wow. It's just really dark brown and it almost looks thicker than, you know, you would normally expect. And so that's what they're taking into the water treatment system. And that's what they're trying to filter to a level that would be, a good standard for drinking. And that is really difficult. It takes a lot longer. And they're not able to filter. The last I heard, they're not able to treat the amount of water that Austin typically uses in a day. So they're looking at the city reserves drop. That was the last word from the water utility.
I see. Now we're seeing reports that coffee shops can't serve coffee. Restaurants are closed. How is this affecting businesses in town?
It is kind of wild to see how the kind of domino effect here. I mean, initially, yesterday, we saw kind of a rush on bottled water at the supermarkets. That seems to have stabilized. But yeah, you go to a restaurant. My mom's visiting from out of town. We went to a restaurant last night. No ice for the cocktails, right? Cafes absolutely closed most of them are not boiling the amount of water they would need to in order to be able to serve the volume that they typically serve. And so, yeah, there's just a lot of different impacts here.
And it's not just restaurants and businesses; it's everyday people. It's, you know, you live in the city, you've got to deal with this.
Yeah, I mean, they're asking people to conserve. I skipped my shower this morning. We're trying to lower the amount of water that we're taking out of the system because, like I said, they're concerned about their ability to treat and put it back in. And then, of course, if you are taking water from your taps, you do need to boil it because they're not able to get the amount of kind of the silt, this particulate matter out that they'd like to.
And just real quick, any word when the order will be lifted?
The last I heard, it could be up to 2 weeks.
Wow. All right. Yeah. Mose Bushell covers energy and the environment for KUT in Austin. Mose, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
When you think of the titans of technology, who comes to mind? Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg? How about Patrick McGovern? He founded a company called International Data Corporation back in 1964. It produced magazines like Computer World, Macworld, and PC World, and similar publications around the world. McGovern, who died in 2014, became a billionaire as the company grew. And author Glenn Rifkin has just written a book about him called Future Forward. Glenn Rifkin, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks, Jeremy. It's great to be here.
So Patrick McGovern, not a household name, but very important guy. Who was he?
Well, he was the entrepreneur and visionary who started a company called International Data Group, IDG. And what he saw was that the information technology revolution was getting started in the early 60s. It was slow and, you know, steady, but he saw something bigger happening. And over those years, he decided that somebody needed to tell the story of this revolution. It was one thing to be the Bill Gates or the Thomas Watson Jr. who made things, the software and the hardware, but somebody needed to chronicle what was going on, and that was his mission.
So he created Computer World, magazine Computer World, and Macworld as well.
He created actually nearly 300 publications around the world over the course of 50 years running the company. But yes, the first publication was Computer World, which became the Bible of the information technology industry.
What was in it? What would you find in Computer World?
Well, it was news, weekly news. It was product reviews and things like that. But mostly it was taking a look at the people and players in the industry, the companies that were moving and shaking. They were big in covering IBM in the late 60s into the 70s when they were the 800-pound gorilla in the industry space. And as it moved along, as the industry changed, the personal computer was created in the 1980s. Computer World would be the newspaper of record, so to speak. It was kind of the New York Times of the computer industry.
Well, I was also thinking about it in comparison to Bloomberg, which, you know, people on Wall Street, they've all got these Bloomberg terminals, which they pay a lot of money for just to get information. So they have the latest information. Is that the same kind of thing? Who is he talking to with Computer World and Mac World?
Well, Computer World and Macworld would be slightly different audiences. Macworld was really aimed right away at the Apple market. Mm-hmm. Back in, it started on the day they released the Macintosh computer
but
in 1984.
But like tech people or investors or who?
This would have been, the Computer World was aimed early on at data processing managers, DP managers, who mm-hmm. morphed into what we now think of as CIOs, chief information officers. It wouldn't, there were no terminals set up like Bloomberg. This was strictly a newspaper. Today, obviously, it's strictly online, but you know, over the course of those three or four decades, Computer World was a print publication, and it was aimed at offering technology people an insight into what the products were, who was using them, how they were using them, and they made the big leap, which was an important leap, in showing that these guys were not just techies hidden behind mm-hmm. glass walls. These people were going to contribute big time to the business because technology was going to drive things.
And you worked there at Computer World.
I did. I joined in 1983 at the time. Didn't know a computer from a washing machine. If I could turn on the on switch, I was happy. Mm-hmm. Never dreamed of getting involved in the technology industry. But I got a job there at a time when jobs were a little bit scarce and ended up just loving it because something really exciting was happening. I started interviewing Bill Gates and Steve Jobs before the New York Times and Wall Street Journal did. So I was, you know, right there, as I say in the book, at the tip of my keyboard, things were happening. And I stayed there for 7 years, at which time, during which time I got to know Pat McGovern.
So what was it about him that was so special?
Well, there's lots of visionaries, lots of entrepreneurs out there who've done great things. But Pat had a very unique style of management and leadership, which is what the book is about, that he saw the world differently. He didn't need to be in the spotlight. What he wanted was to fulfill a mission. And one of the keys to him to fulfill this mission was to treat his employees around the world in a way that most companies didn't. And this was a guy, for example, at the holidays, he would go around to every office in the United States. We're talking about 5,000 people at the time. Mm-hmm. He would go to every desk. He would meet and greet every employee. He knew if you had worked there before and he'd seen you the year before, he not only remembered your name, he knew your wife's name. He knew how many kids you had. He would congratulate you on some project that you did, and he would thank you for the contributions you were making to the company. And then he would hand you a holiday card, which was stuffed with cash, a holiday bonus. Mm-hmm. And people were blown away by this. I was blown away by this when it happened. I'd heard that it was happening, but when you don't believe it until he actually shows up at your desk. And this need, this desire to make a connection to every employee, I mean, I can't think of another CEO who did that.
Well, and it's great in terms of fostering a really nice atmosphere for the worker, but he was also able to make a lot of money. And you point out, you go through a number of business lessons from Pat McGovern, and one of them is that he would allow ideas to develop. He would, you say he would give people, what, 3/4 of losses until he finally put a stop to things. But basically, he'd give people a long time to try things out, to experiment.
One of Pat's mottos, one of the actual corporate values, the 10 corporate values of the company, is let's try it. And his idea was that great ideas were going to emanate from everywhere and anywhere inside the company. If somebody was smart enough to come up with the idea, could make a case for the idea, he said, let's try it. And he would give you some funding and he would let you go with it. And it created numerous publications. It created numerous opportunities. One of the great stories that came from that attitude was the Four Dummies books, which are now—
Those are from him.
Those were originally from—
Like DOS for Dummies.
DOS for Dummies,
like
absolutely. There was they started a book division, and they had this gentleman named John Kilcullen who'd come in. The division wasn't doing well at all. He remembered a story about a friend who was at a computer store back in the 80s and— asked the clerk, listen, I need a book about this MS-DOS thing, you know, but I don't know anything. It's got to be something like DOS for Dummies. And Kilcullen remembered that title, suggested to McGovern, let's do a series of books about this. And McGovern thought, well, we're insulting our readers if we're calling them dummies. And Kilcullen said, no, what we're doing is this is pre-YouTube, pre-internet. We can give them really reasonable instructions on how to be smart about technology because technology is complicated. So they went with that, and the Four Dummies books became this remarkable global brand. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally 2,000 or 3,000 titles in print.
The other thing that was interesting as I was reading your book is that he, early on, this is decades ago, really took an interest in China. He would go over there. He would have meetings with people. He would eat all kinds of crazy things when he would do business deals that would impress his Chinese colleagues because he was willing to try things like that.
Well, like I said, Pat was a visionary, and one of the places that his vision took place was in China. He showed up there in 1978. He actually got off a plane where he wasn't legally allowed to. Mm-hmm. There were no diplomatic relations with China at the time. He somehow talked his way into the city of Beijing, which was called Peking then, and he wandered around the streets. He had one day to do this. And can you only imagine this 6'3" massive American in a dark business suit wandering around the streets of Beijing, looking in bookstores, looking at what people were doing, and realizing that there was, number one, a massive population, and number two, they were starved for information. And there was going to be an opportunity here that he was going to get into well before anyone. And 2 years later, he went back, made a deal with one of the ministries, and he was publishing China Computer World by October of 1980.
So how would he want to be remembered right now? You've written this book about him. What do you think he would want people to know about him?
Well, one thing I didn't mention is in 2000, he and his wife, Lori, donated $350 million to MIT to start the McGovern Institute for Brain Research. And so his driving force throughout his professional life was the combination of technology and research into the human mind. He was just fascinated by that.
Even though he had nobody in his family that had any problems with their brains or anything like that?
It was just he'd read a book when he was 16 years old called Giant Brains that was supposed to be – it wasn't science fiction. It was a look at what might happen in the future, that computers would allow us to study the human mind in a way that had never been done before. And that's just stuck with him for the rest of his life. So when he funded the Brain Institute, what he foresaw was the melding of computer information technology with brain research. And it is, in fact, what's come to pass. The Brain Research Institute at MIT is world class. It's doing some amazing work. And he would be so proud of that legacy. That's really where he wanted to leave his mark.
That is Glenn Rifkin, who looks at the legacy of Patrick McGovern in his new book, Future Forward. Glenn, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
A huge oil spill that started 14 years ago in the Gulf of Mexico off the coast of Louisiana continues today and could surpass the 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster as the largest spill in U.S. history. It was triggered by Hurricane Ivan, and Taylor Energy, the company that owned the wells that are leaking, tried to keep the spill hidden from the public, according to a new report from the Washington Post. Daryl Fears is the reporter who broke that story, and Daryl, you write that 300 to 700 barrels a day have been spilling into the Gulf as a result of all this. How did it start?
14 years ago, there was an enormous monster hurricane called Ivan. It swept through the Gulf and knocked down an oil platform just 12 miles off the coast of Louisiana. So when the hurricane knocked it over, of course, it's attached to many wells. And when the hurricane triggered a mudslide that slammed into the legs of the oil platform, and when it tumbled over, its the lines to 28 wells snapped. And it's believed that all those wells opened up and started leaking.
If those wells opened up and started leaking 14 years ago and are spilling up to 700 barrels a day into the Gulf, how is it possible that we have not been talking about this oil spill?
That's a really good question. And it turns out that Taylor Energy wanted to keep this quiet because Taylor Energy felt that there was a lot of proprietary information related to this spill and its operation, and it did not want the Coast Guard, which managed the spill at the time, actually a unified command of the Coast Guard and some other federal agencies, did not want them to make this public and start talking about those operations.
Well, and at one point, the company was saying that only 2 barrels of oil a day were spilling into the ocean. Is that right?
I think that that is right. And I think that that went on for about 6 years or maybe 4 years until in 2008, the Coast Guard said that there is a continuous leak here. It is evident, and it is a danger to the environment. And that's when Taylor Energy and the federal government entered into a trust to clean up the mess that the hurricane made.
Why can't a crew take a submersible down there and cap off this well to stop the leak?
Well, it's a very complicated and risky operation. So when you think back to Hurricane Ivan and the basically avalanche of mud it caused that slammed to the legs of the platform and brought it down, it then buried the wells under about 150 feet of just muck, just underground muck. And it was almost impenetrable. I think that Taylor Energy was able to get its consultants to plug about a third of the 28 wells, but it couldn't get to them all. And it was so risky. They would have to bore through the mud. They would have to do a lot of drilling. And the fear was that it could strike one of the wells inadvertently and just open up an explosion of oil, which would be similar to Deepwater Horizon. And no one wanted that.
That would make it worse. But at this point, we still have a steady leak of oil. Does that create some sort of environmental hazard? I assume that impacts the marine wildlife in the area.
Exactly. People are calling it a disaster in slow motion. And what we haven't talked about here is that this leak has been going on for 14 years, yes. But the federal government that oversees this operation has estimated that this leak will continue for the next 80 years, for the rest of the century.
Wow.
And that is a major concern. For whatever reason, and I think that NOAA has the answer for this, and NOAA wouldn't participate in this story, but NOAA has not begun its assessment of the damage that this is causing. And so NOAA has the answer for some things here.
While all this is happening, the Trump administration is proposing to expand offshore leases for oil and gas, including pretty much all up and down the Atlantic coast. So there's that issue to grapple with. But also it makes you wonder how these oil and gas platforms are damaged and affected by hurricanes. We just saw the devastation that Michael did on land in the Florida Panhandle. What about at sea?
Right. So obviously there are a lot of hurricanes in the Gulf and even more hurricanes in the Atlantic. And every time there's a hurricane in the Gulf, oil platforms are damaged, sometimes severely damaged, sometimes shut down. And the industry is really getting better with dealing with hurricanes, but are they getting better fast enough? There have been, I think, through times, about 600 hurricanes recorded in the Gulf of Mexico. There's more than double that in the Atlantic. And that's where President Trump is proposing to offer federal leases. Actually, President Trump is proposing to offer federal leases on 90% on the of the outer U.S. continental shelf, which is unprecedented. It's the largest expansion in U.S. history. And that is what brought us to this story, looking at what would the Atlantic look like if President Trump's vision was realized. And we turned to the Gulf to answer that question.
Well, and those hurricanes are also getting stronger. Daryl Fears is a reporter who covers the environment for The Washington Post. Thanks for your story, and thanks for speaking with us.
I appreciate your having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.